Imagine you were staring at a coach's whiteboard right in the middle of this, like, incredibly tense timeout.
Oh, yeah, the classic high-pressure moment.
Exactly. The coach is furiously dragging these red and blue dry erase markers across the plastic. They're tapping the board, yelling instructions over the roar of the arena.
And you just have seconds to process it all.
Right. And you look at the board, and what do you actually see? I mean, it looks like chaotic scribbles, just a bowl of geometric alphabet soup.
Complete chaos.
Yeah. There are squiggles, dashed lines, triangles, little floating numbers. And you are looking at a communicative landscape that is, honestly, the Wild West.
That is the perfect way to describe it.
Because if you misread one triangle
Yeah.
or, misinterpret one squiggly line, you've blown a coverage.
Oh, absolutely.
You could give up a game-winning odd man rush just because you thought the diagram was telling you to apply pressure, but it was actually telling you to stop.
It is a massive vulnerability in the sport. I mean, think about it. When we talk about technical instructions in almost any other field, there is this strict expectation of standardization.
Right, like an instruction manual.
Exactly. You look at an electrical schematic or an architectural blueprint, and a resistor is a resistor. A load-bearing wall is a load-bearing wall, no matter what country you're in.
Because it has to be.
Right. It's binary, it's heavily regulated, and it's universal. But the visual language of ice hockey strategy, it possesses literally no universal standard.
Which is just wild to me. And that is exactly what we are dissecting today in this deep dive. We are taking this massive stack of source material specifically, this really highly detailed, comprehensive guide on reading and standardizing ice hockey diagrams.
And it is a fascinating document.
It really is. And we are going to unpack the sheer chaos of this visual language.
Yeah.
Because if you're a coach or a player or, even just a hardcore analyst of the game, rote memorization of these symbols just isn't enough.
No, it shatters completely.
Yeah, memorization shatters under the pressure of a 30-second timeout. We need to build a robust, intuitive mental model so you can actually read, retain, and critically apply these diagrams on the fly.
The foundational revelation of our source material today is that the visual language of coaching symbols is entirely unstandardized by the governing bodies of the sport.
They just don't regulate it.
Not at all. I mean, we have strictly enforced laws for the game itself, right?
Yeah.
Like what constitutes a hook, how offsides is called, the exact dimensions of the crease.
Down to the millimeter.
Exactly. But the way we draw a breakout, it's completely left to interpretation.
Right. And the specific guide we are looking at today had to make incredibly tough choices because of that lack of standardization. It had to build its own visual dictionary from scratch.
It had to act as a Rosetta Stone.
Yeah. And whoever wrote this guide literally had to stitch together two entirely different dialects just to create something functional. They pulled from two major published keys.
Right, the IIHF and the HEO.
Yep, the IIHF, the International Ice Hockey Federation, their coach development program, and a handout from the Hockey Eastern Ontario, or HEO, NCCP Development One Clinic.
It is a total hybrid language born completely out of necessity.
Because neither one works on its own.
Right. Neither the IIHF nor the HEO keys are perfect. They have glaring omissions and, in some cases, catastrophic contradictions.
Which we will definitely get into.
Oh, we have to. So, as we systematically break down how to read these diagrams today, you, the listener, need to adopt an active, critical mindset. As we unpack these symbols, really ask yourself, if I saw this specific mark on a random whiteboard in an unfamiliar locker room, would I actually know what the coach's intent was?
Or would I just be guessing?
Exactly. Or are you just guessing based on context clues?
Because guessing on the ice is how you end up staring at the rafters after a minus one shift.
It really is.
So if we're dealing with a fractured language, we have to start with the baseline vocabulary, the nouns of our sentences.
Players.
Right, who's actually on the ice? How do we visually build a roster on a piece of paper?
The primary mechanism for identifying players is the relationship between shape and position.
Okay.
In the hybrid system we are studying, the rule is strictly defined. A circle represents a forward.
Circle is forward.
Right. A triangle represents a defenseman, and a bare letter G with no shape drawn around it is a goaltender.
Okay, so circle equals forward, triangle equals D. Now, I know a lot of people just memorize that and move on, but if we want this to be a permanent mental model, we have to connect the visual to the physical reality of the position.
We need an anchor.
Exactly. So think about it like this. A circle is inherently mobile, is fluid. It can roll or pivot in any direction instantly without catching an edge.
That is a great way to picture it.
Right. That perfectly mimics the kinetic reality of a forward, sweeping through the neutral zone, constantly altering their angle of attack.
That is an excellent cognitive anchor. The visual design literally reflects the physical mandate of the role.
And the triangle perfectly reflects the defenseman. Because a triangle has a wide, solid, anchored base.
Yeah.
Ellis planted.
It's stable.
Yeah. When you picture a D-man holding the offensive blue line or boxing out in the low slot, they have that wide, stable stance. They are the anchor of the structure.
Exactly. But here's the critical rule that the source material emphasizes and where, frankly, many readers fail.
Oh, the shape rule.
Yes. A player's shape never changes based on the flow of play. Shape follows the player, not the geographic role they happen to be filling in a specific second.
I'm so glad you brought this up because hockey is arguably the most fluid transition game on earth.
It never stops moving.
Right. So let's say you have an F3 high in the offensive zone. The puck turns over and that forward is suddenly the first man back.
They are the last line of defense.
Exactly. They are, for all intents and purposes, playing defense on the rush. Does their shape change on the diagram to reflect that they are now defending?
Absolutely not. They remain a circle. A winger backchecking is a circle.
Even deep in their own zone.
Correct. And a defenseman pinching deep below the opposing goal line, effectively playing as a forward, remains a triangle. They do not morph shapes just because they crossed a blue line.
Which is vital for understanding defensive responsibilities.
Well, right? Immensely vital.
Because if you have a two-on-one rush coming back at you, and the diagram shows a circle defending the rush instead of a triangle, that tells you something critical about the tactical situation.
It changes everything.
A forward defending a two-on-one has different instincts, a different gap control, and totally different muscle memory than a natural defenseman.
Exactly.
If the shapes just change to match the zone, you'd lose all that vital context.
Precisely. If shapes changed based on puck possession or zone, a diagram of a neutral zone turnover would just look like a kaleidoscope of morphing geometry.
Just shapes popping in and out.
Right. The visual stability of the noun allows the verbs to make sense.
Okay, so shape dictates the position on the roster. But there are 10 skaters on the ice. How do we distinguish our five from their five?
That brings us to the rule of fill, which dictates team identity.
Okay, open versus close.
Right. In this specific guide, an open or unfilled shape represents your team. A solid or filled-in shape represents the opposition.
Open is us, solid is them. Now, this seems like a pretty standard convention, but the source text points out something that kind of blew my mind regarding the official keys.
Yes. The official keys give you absolutely no guidance here.
Wait, really?
Really? Neither the II or HF nor the HEO source documents actually tell you what the fills mean.
That is insane.
It is. If you look at their published keys, they just print a row of solid shapes and a row of open shapes. They offer you the visual options without assigning them any intrinsic meaning whatsoever.
Which is wild. They just say, here are some circles. Good luck figuring out who is on your team.
Essentially, yes.
So the author of our guide had to plant a flag and establish a strict house rule to prevent total chaos. But I want to push on the design logic here for a second. Why use open versus solid at all? Why not just use red ink for the bad guys and blue ink for the good guys? That's what they do on television broadcasts.
It comes down to the stark reality of how coaching materials are actually distributed in the real world.
Like physically?
Yes. Whiteboards get erased, but system manuals get printed. And they are rarely printed on high-end color presses. A head coach is usually printing a 50-page playbook on a cheap laser printer in the back office.
Right.
And if you rely on red and blue ink to tell the teams apart, what happens when that playbook is photocopied in black and white?
The red and blue just compress into identical muddy shades of gray.
Exactly. Suddenly, a player looking at the handout cannot tell if the defenseman on the page is their teammate or an opposing threat.
That is a disaster.
It is. Furthermore, relying on color completely alienates players or coaches with color vision deficiencies.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that.
Right. By relying on the fill of the shape hollow versus solid, the diagram remains perfectly legible in grayscale, in cheap photocopies, and is universally accessible regardless of color vision.
It's a bulletproof design choice. It survives the medium it's printed on.
It has to.
But earlier you mentioned that we need a critical mindset because these systems clash. And this brings us to what the text highlights as a massive hidden trap.
The IIHF trap.
Yes, the IIHF trap.
It is arguably the single most dangerous misconception a player or coach can bring into a locker room.
Let's really unpack this because if you get this wrong, the entire diagram inverses on you.
Okay, so remember our baseline rule for this hybrid guide: shape equals position, circle is forward, triangle is D.
Right.
But if you look at the IIHF's own internal key, the system used internationally by the governing body, they flip the entire logic upside down. In the IIHF key, they use shapes to dictate the teams.
So the shape has literally nothing to do with whether you are a forward or a defenseman.
Correct. The IIHF uses circles for the entire offensive team and triangles for the entire defensive team.
Wait, so in an IIHF diagram,
Right.
an offensive defenseman on the power play is drawn as a circle.
Yes.
That hurts my brain.
And they indicate the actual position of the player by putting a number inside the shape. Number one is goalie, two is right defense, up to six for left wing.
Let's look at the real-world fallout of this contradiction. Picture a European prospect who has come up entirely through the IIHF system.
Oh.
They are hardwired to read triangles as the defending team. Now, they get drafted, they come over to a North American club that uses the guide we are studying today.
This happens all the time.
Right. The coach hands them a diagram of a 1-2-2 forecheck. The player looks at the board and they see a solid triangle positioned high in the offensive zone.
And what does their brain tell them?
Because of their IIHF training, their brain immediately says, "Ah, a triangle. That's just a player on the defending team."
But in the North American hybrid system, a triangle specifically means a defenseman.
Exactly. So the player assumes they are supposed to be forechecking a defensive winger when actually the playbook is explicitly warning them about an opposing defenseman who has stepped up into the play.
It's a complete misread.
If you misread the noun, you fundamentally misread the tactical threat. You'll take the wrong angle, you'll anticipate the wrong passing options, and you'll blow the coverage.
This is why I stress this golden rule for anyone studying hockey strategy. Always, always check the key of the specific document you are reading.
You can never assume.
Never. The word international in the IIHF title creates this dangerous illusion of universal standardization. The guide we are studying explicitly warns readers: do not call this notation international to anyone.
Wow, really?
Yes, because calling it international implies it is the singular global standard, which is demonstrably false.
It's basically a localized dialect pretending to be a universal language.
Precisely.
All right, so we know shape is position and fill is team identity, but what about the letters inside the shapes? You'll often see an F1 or an F2 inside that circle.
Right.
I think a lot of beginners assume F1 means the center, F2 means the right wing, etc.
That is a very common misinterpretation. It is vital to understand that those letters indicate tactical roles based on the flow of the play, not fixed roster positions.
So F1 just means forward one.
Yes, meaning the first forward to arrive at the puck or enter the zone. It dictates the order of operations.
Like on a dump-in.
Exactly. If you dump the puck into the corner, the F1 is the first player in on the forecheck to establish pressure, regardless of whether that player happens to be your center or your left winger in the actual lineup.
And F2.
F2 provides secondary support. If a playbook put fixed positions inside the glyphs, say, demanding the center always be the first man in it, would completely destroy the fluidity of the transition game.
Because the center might be changing lines or stuck behind the play.
Right. The letters describe what you are doing in that specific moment, not what it says on the back of your hockey card.
And speaking of the center, the text points out a really funny collision of symbols here.
Ah, the C
I
collision.
love this part.
In almost all published coaching manuals and drill books, if you see a circled letter C, it designates the coach.
The person physically running the practice drill and blowing the whistle.
Right. But in the specific tactical guide we are studying, a circled C means the center, the player taking the face-off.
Which means if you aren't paying close attention to the context, you might look at a defensive zone breakout diagram and think, wow, the coach is really getting aggressively involved in the play here. He's parked right in the low slot.
It's hilarious, but it really highlights how easily wires get crossed when we lack a master dictionary.
It really does.
Now, alongside the players, we have the most important object on the ice, which is the puck.
Right. And you would think the puck would be the easiest thing to standardize.
You would think so. In this guide, it is drawn as a small solid dot, roughly one-third the width of a player glyph.
Simple enough.
But here is the shocking fact from the source material. Neither the HEO nor the IIHF keys actually have a standard published mark for a single standalone puck sitting on the ice.
Wait, I have to make sure I heard that right. the official published keys for ice hockey strategy diagrams don't have a symbol for the puck itself.
They do not.
How is that possible?
Well, they have symbols for a cluster of pucks, usually used to show where the coach is standing with a bucket of them to start a drill.
Okay.
And they have symbols for the puck in motion, like passes and shots, but they offer no standardized mark for just a single puck resting on the ice, waiting to be picked up or contested.
That is baffling.
The author of our guide had to invent and standardize that solid dot themselves to fill a massive gap in the official vocabulary.
That is unbelievable. It was like writing a dictionary and forgetting to include the word ball.
Pretty much.
Okay, one final noun to establish before we start moving these pieces around. The pylon.
This one is simple but strictly enforced. An X is a pylon, a practice cone.
Okay, but I see X's and O's used in football and basketball all the time to represent players.
Yes, but in this specific hockey language, an X is never a player. It is an inanimate plastic cone used for edge work or spacing in a drill.
So don't pass to it.
If a player misreads an X as a teammate and tries to pass to it, the diagram has failed.
Okay, so let's pause here. What should we remember from this section before we move on? Let's synthesize.
Great idea.
So, shapes define the position on the roster. Circles are mobile forwards. Triangles are anchored defensemen. And this never changes during the flow of play, right?
Correct. The shape is the player, not the zone.
Right. And fills define the team. Open is us, solid is them. Keeping things legible in black and white.
Essential for printing.
And we have to guard against the IIHF trap, where shapes equal teams. Letters are arrival roles, not roster spots. And an X is a piece of plastic.
You've got the nouns.
We have our nouns on the ice. But hockey isn't played standing still. It's the fastest game on earth. We have to make these static shapes move. We need the verbs.
If the players are the nouns, the lines trailing behind them or projecting in front of them are the verbs.
The movement.
Right. They describe exactly how that player is navigating the ice and the type of momentum they are carrying. Let's start with the baseline of locomotion, which is skating forward.
The most common action on the ice. How do we draw a player just digging in and skating straight ahead?
A plain straight line ending in an arrowhead represents forward skating without the puck. Just pure, unencumbered speed to a location.
Straight line. Simple enough. But the moment you add the puck, the physics of skating change. And the diagram reflects that beautifully.
It does. When a player is carrying the puck, the straight line changes to a long, smooth wave ending in an arrow.
The wave.
Yes. This represents skating and stick handling.
I love the visual intuition here. A straight arrow is raw speed cutting through the air, but a wave implies rhythm and lateral weight transfer.
That's a great way to think about it.
Because when you watch a player stick handling through the neutral zone, they aren't just moving straight ahead. Their body sways, their hands are moving side to side. They are manipulating the puck across your body line. The wave perfectly captures the physical rhythm of puck control.
The visual design elegantly matches the biomechanics, but the complexity scales up significantly when we look at backward skating.
And this is where the two source dictionaries, the IIHF and the HEO, violently clash again.
Correct. The HEO document draws backward skating as a tight, narrow wave, almost like a coiled spring.
Okay.
But the author of the guide we are analyzing explicitly rejects that HEO symbol. Instead, they adopt the IIHF method for backward skating.
And what does the IIHF symbol look like?
It looks like a row of separate, overlapping, flattened arches. Imagine drawing a series of lowercase n's that stack slightly onto each other in a continuous line.
I know a lot of coaches find that symbol tedious to draw compared to a quick wave. Why did our guide choose these weird little overlapping arches?
Because of the brilliant physical mimicry of the symbol.
How does it mimic the physical act?
To truly retain this mental model, we have to connect it to the ice. When a hockey player skates backward, they do not use a standard forward stride. How do they generate power?
They use a C cut. You carve the inside edge of your skate blade into the ice in the shape of a half circle, pushing outward and backward to propel your center of gravity.
Exactly. Each one of those overlapping arches in the diagram literally represents a single C cut.
Oh, wow.
It is a visual representation of the physical path the skate blade is carving into the ice, just turned on its side.
That's so cool.
When you look at that symbol, you are quite literally looking at a drawing of the player's footprints.
Once you see it as the literal marks left on the ice, you can never unsee it. It makes total intuitive sense. The tight wave of the HEO might be faster to draw, but the IIHF overlapping arches contain actual biomechanical information.
It's functional geometry.
Right. And what if they aren't just pushing straight back? What if a defenseman is retreating but needs to gain speed on a curve, like defending a rush out of the corner?
For backward crossovers, the symbol shifts to a sharp zigzag line.
Again, physical mimicry. A crossover is an aggressive, angular crossing step. You are snapping one skate over the other. A zigzag feels sharp and aggressive.
It perfectly matches the kinetic energy of a backward crossover.
Okay, so we know how the players move, but how does the puck move between them?
A pass is represented by a dashed arrow, a broken line.
I think about this like a stone skipping over water. A dashed line visually communicates the loss of physical contact.
That's exactly it.
The puck is no longer gliding securely on the blade of the stick. It's a physical object being launched, breaking contact with the origin, perhaps skipping over the rough ice and arriving at the destination.
That is a highly effective way to conceptualize it. The broken line represents the separation of the puck from the player.
Right.
Now, what if the puck isn't being passed to a teammate, but is being propelled at the net with the intent to score?
A shot.
A shot is depicted as a double line ending in an arrow, two parallel straight lines.
It just looks heavier, you know? A pass is a dashed line. It's light, airy, cooperative. A shot is a double line. It carries maximum velocity, force, and violence. It visually communicates the intensity of the action.
It creates an immediate hierarchy of threat on the page.
It really does.
Now, let's explore a movement that bridges the gap between offense and defense. Lateral movement.
Okay.
This is where a player is moving sideways across the ice, typically facing the puck but shuffling parallel to the blue line.
And the history of this specific symbol in our source guide is fascinating, because it exposes another massive hole in the official keys.
It does. The final symbol for lateral movement in our guide is a line with short vertical bars crossing it, resembling railroad tracks.
Right.
The origin story here is critical. This is the only line symbol that our guide adopted from the HEO sheet instead of the IIHF key.
Why abandon the IIHF here? Were their lateral tracks poorly designed?
No, the IIHF key simply doesn't have a lateral symbol at all.
They just skipped it entirely.
They completely omitted lateral crossovers or side shuffles from their visual vocabulary. If you are an IIHF coach trying to draw a power play umbrella where the point man walks the blue line laterally, you literally do not have a line to draw that.
That is a staggering omission for a modern game built entirely on east-west puck movement.
It really is.
So our guide had to borrow from the HEO, but the HEO symbol was broken too, right?
Deeply flawed. The original HEO symbol just draws a bare picket fence of short vertical bars.
Just floating there.
Exactly. No line running horizontally through them, and crucially, no arrowhead at the end.
Which renders it functionally useless. If I look at a whiteboard and just see a bunch of hash marks hovering near the blue line, how do I know if the defenseman is walking the line to the left to open a shooting lane, or shuffling to the right to execute a D-to-D pass?
You don't. It lacked directionality.
Unbelievable.
So the author of our guide had to perform surgery on the symbol. They took the HEO bars, ran a solid horizontal line through them to connect the movement, and added an arrowhead so the reader actually knows where the player is going.
That's so smart.
It's a perfect example of why this guide is a hybrid. It identifies the flaws and omissions in the original source material and engineers practical solutions so a learner can actually execute the play.
It's like finding a word in French that doesn't exist in English.
Yeah.
Adopting it, but changing the pronunciation so your teammates can actually understand it.
Exactly.
Okay. To round out the verbs, we have specialized actions, the unique maneuvers that don't fit into basic locomotion.
First is the pivot. This is when a player transitions from forward skating to backward skating, or vice versa, without losing momentum.
How does that look?
It is drawn as a curve turning back on itself, resembling a small loop or a J-hook at the point of transition.
Makes sense. Next is a crucial tactical element, which is blocking or screening, getting your physical body in the way of an opposing player, or taking away the goaltender's eyes.
This is drawn as a single arc at the end of a line.
Like a bracket.
Yes. Imagine a forward skating route into the high slot, and at the end of that route, there is a curved bracket facing outward, like a physical shield. That bracket represents the player establishing a screen.
And finally, dropping the puck.
Mm-hmm.
The drop pass. This is a highly specific play where a player carrying the puck doesn't actively pass it, but simply leaves it dead on the ice for a trailing teammate to pick up with speed.
The standard way both published keys draw this action is incredibly cluttered. They draw the wave to show the puck being carried, then a distinct marker, and then a trailing straight line for the player skating away.
It's just too much ink.
It is. The guide we are studying ruthlessly streamlines this. It draws just a plain line with a small, distinct marker partway along it.
It minimizes the visual noise. You don't need to see the wave to know they carried the puck to that spot. You just need to know exactly where the physical object is being abandoned. It reduces the cognitive load on the reader.
Precisely. In high-pressure situations, visual clutter is the enemy of execution.
So let's do a quick retrieval. If we synthesize our verbs, what do we have? Straight line is speed. Wave is puck control.
Correct.
Overlapping C cuts for backward skating mimics the physical footprints on the ice. Railroad tracks show lateral movement. And dashed lines mean the puck is airborne or separated from the stick.
You've mastered the movement.
We've learned how to place our players, and we've learned how to make them move across the ice. But momentum eventually has to stop. And here is where the landscape gets truly treacherous.
It really does.
In the world of hockey diagrams, stopping is where the most dangerous tactical misinterpretations hide.
This specific area of study separates a beginner from an expert.
How so?
Well, a beginner merely looks at where a line ends on the page. An expert looks at how the line terminates, because the specific termination symbol dictates the tactical intent of the arrival.
Okay, let's examine the baseline then, the two-bar stop. Describe the visual for the listener.
It is a line indicating movement, and at the very end, instead of a directional arrowhead, there are two short, parallel bars cutting perpendicularly across the line.
Like a T.
Exactly. It resembles a capital T with an extra crossbar. Both the IIHF and HEO recognize this as stop, though IIHF calls it a sudden stop, and HEO simply calls it stopping.
But the guide we are analyzing reveals a massive context-dependent nuance here.
Yes. The context rule. This singular symbol possesses two entirely distinct tactical meanings, depending purely on where on the ice the termination happens.
The location changes the meaning.
Radically. If that route ends in open ice, for example, in the middle of the neutral zone with no opposing players around, it is interpreted literally as a sudden stop.
Okay, just stop skating.
Right. The player skates to that geographic coordinate and aggressively hits the brakes to hold that space.
But hockey is fundamentally a contact sport. We don't just skate to empty ice, we skate to engage the opponent. What happens if that line ends directly on top of an opposing player's shape?
That changes everything.
Right, because if I'm an F1 on the forecheck, my job isn't to politely stop in front of the opposing D-man. My job is to separate him from the puck.
Exactly. And this is why, if the line ends on an opponent, you do not read the two bars as a literal stop in the sense of halting your momentum to avoid them.
What do you read it as?
You read it as a tactical command to, quote, arrive under control.
I found the philosophical logic behind this in the source text to be absolutely brilliant. Because my first instinct is, if I want my player to hit the opponent, why don't I just draw an arrowhead pointing right into the opposing player's chest?
Because visual language dictates intent. An arrowhead fundamentally implies continuing through a destination.
Right.
If a coach draws an arrow directly through a defending player, it visually suggests that the forechecker is supposed to skate straight through their physical body.
Which is biologically impossible and tactically reckless.
Exactly. If you try to skate through a player, you throw yourself out of position. The two bars mean your route terminates at them.
You engage.
You engage them, you pin them to the boards, you apply heavy physical pressure, but your forward momentum terminates at their position.
It's the difference between skate to this guy, engage him, and dictate his movement, versus skate through this guy like he's a ghost and take yourself out of the play.
That is the perfect way to phrase it.
The two bars mean arrive under control. It is a highly sophisticated way to draw physical engagement. But that brings us to what might be my favorite part of this entire deep dive.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
The missing one-bar symbol.
Oh.
This is an absolute masterclass in why standardization is necessary and what happens when it fails.
It is the most fractured, contradictory symbol in all of hockey coaching literature.
So, just to clarify for the listener, we are talking about a line that ends in a single perpendicular bar, like a standard capital T.
Yes. And the guide we are studying explicitly and deliberately bans this symbol from its visual dictionary.
I have to challenge this, though. If a symbol is common enough to be in the literature, why ban it entirely? If it's confusing, why not just redefine it for your own playbook? Say, in this locker room, one bar means X.
Because you cannot easily overwrite years of ingrained muscle memory, and a symbol with multiple established contradictory meanings is just too dangerous to keep in rotation.
It's radioactive.
It really is. Mm-hmm. Let us look at the three-way split in the published literature that forced this ban.
Okay.
First, in the HEO system, a line ending in one bar means checking pressure. It is an active command to apply physical force to an opponent.
Okay, that seems incredibly useful. Why not just use that definition?
Because of the second viewpoint, in the IIHF key, the one bar symbol simply does not exist.
Not at all.
It is completely absent from their vocabulary. Therefore, if an IIHF trained player sees a line ending in one bar, they won't recognize it.
So what will they think it means?
Worse, because it visually looks exactly like half of the two bar sudden stop symbol we just discussed, they will likely assume it is merely a typo or a poorly drawn sudden stop.
So the coach draws a play asking for aggressive checking pressure, and the IIHF player interprets it as stop halfway before you reach the guy.
Yes.
That is a catastrophic breakdown. But there's a third definition floating around out there, right?
Yes. And this is where the system completely collapses. In a highly respected and widely used coaching manual called Hockey Plays and Strategies by Johnston and Walter, they utilize the one bar symbol to mean screen, pick, or block.
Wait, a screen? Standing perfectly still to block a sight line, that is a completely different tactical universe.
Exactly. Let us engage in a thought experiment to see the real-world consequences of this.
Let's do it.
Imagine you are a coach who drafts a breakout play using the one-bar route, intending it to mean apply checking pressure on the forechecker. You hand this diagram to three different players.
Uh-huh.
The player trained in the HEO system reads it, accelerates, and applies a heavy physical check. Perfect.
Right.
But the IIHF-trained player sees what they think is a broken stop symbol, halts 10 feet away from the opponent, and gives up the passing lane entirely.
Well, no.
And the player trained under Johnston and Walter skates up to the opponent, turns their back, and stands perfectly still, attempting to set a basketball-style pick.
You have three professional athletes looking at the exact same line of ink and executing three completely contradictory game-breaking actions.
This is the definition of a failed communicative landscape. Thus, the author of our guide makes the rigorous, expert choice to omit the one-bar symbol entirely.
Just throw it out.
Exactly. If a symbol has multiple contradictory meanings in the wild, the safest and most effective choice is to eradicate it from your vocabulary and use something unambiguous, like the two-bar arrive under control symbol.
That is the ultimate lesson in why we need to critically evaluate our tools. You can't just redefine a dangerous symbol. You have to remove the hazard. So, to synthesize our understanding of terminations, two bars in open ice mean a sudden stop. Two bars on a player mean arrive under control and engage physically.
Correct.
And one bar means pure, unadulterated chaos, which is why we never draw it. And if we see a coach draw it on a whiteboard, we immediately ask them to clarify their intent.
Never assume intent when the language is fractured. Always verify.
So we have our players, we know their routes, and we know exactly how they're supposed to terminate those routes.
The pieces are all in place.
Right. But a hockey rink isn't just a blank 200-foot sheet of white ice.
Yeah.
Strategically, the ice is divided into highly specific, invisible geographic zones.
The invisible geography.
Yeah. If you listen to hockey broadcasts or sit in a video session, you constantly hear terms like the slot, the half wall, the house, or the royal road. How do we draw a geography that doesn't physically exist?
This introduces a fascinating structural problem. You might logically expect that the governing bodies of hockey would have standardized ways to draw the most important strategic areas of the ice.
You would hope so.
But the revelation in our source material is that shaded regions and faint dashed lines are an entirely custom invention of the guide we are studying.
You're saying neither the IIHF nor the HEO keys use any symbols for strategic zones.
Neither of them.
That's crazy.
The HEO key provides symbols for players, lines, and pucks. The IIHF runs from forward skating to body checking, but offers zero regional or geographic marks.
None at all.
None. If you want to highlight the high danger scoring area, the official dictionaries give you nothing. So the author of our guide had to invent a spatial grammar.
And how did they solve that? Let's say a coach wants to draw the slot, you know, the area right between the faceoff circles in front of the net where most goals are scored. How do they represent that without cluttering the diagram?
They draw it as a tinted, shaded area bounded by a faint dashed edge usually with the name of the region written inside it.
Now, I want to emphasize a reality check here for the listener. Picture a pristine NHL ice rink before warmups. You see the thick red center line, you see the blue lines, you see the red face-off circle.
Right, the painted lines.
What you do not see is a giant dashed box painted in the middle of the ice in front of the goalie. With one hyper-specific exception, the goaltender's trapezoid behind the net, none of this shaded strategic geography is actually painted on the ice.
And that is exactly why the guide insists on drawing the edges of these regions as thin dashed lines. It is a highly intentional design choice.
To keep it abstract.
Exactly. If you drew the slot with a thick, solid red line, a young player might intuitively look for that line on the physical ice. The broken, faint edge visually separates the physical reality of the painted rink from the abstract mental model of the strategy.
It separates the concrete from the conceptual. I love that distinction.
Yeah.
And that abstract geometry applies to another custom invention in the guide, which are faint dashed lines with no tint inside them. What do these represent?
These represent pure spatial relationships, sight lines and angles. Imagine a faint dashed line running directly from a defenseman's eyes to the opposing net. Nobody is going to physically skate along that line. The puck isn't currently traveling on it. It exists purely to show you a geometric angle.
Oh, like demonstrating a closed-off shooting lane or highlighting the royal road that splits the offensive zone. It's showing you what the player is looking at or how their body positioning is blocking a specific trajectory.
Exactly. It maps the invisible geometry of the game. But the most critical part of this spatial mapping, and where readers frequently make catastrophic errors, involves the meaning of color and tint depth within those shaded regions.
The danger of shading. Let's get deeply into this, because human intuition actually works against the reader here.
It really does.
When I look at playbook and I see a zone shaded red and another zone shaded blue, my immediate hardwired assumption is that red means bad, hazard, stay away, and blue means good, safe, go here. Is that correct?
Not automatically, and assuming so can lead to executing the exact opposite of the coach's intent.
Wait.
Yes. The shading itself does not dictate the tactical command. The text caption of the diagram dictates the command.
So the color is just an identifier.
Think of it this way. You might have one diagram where a red zone indicates an area you desperately want to trap the opponent inside, and another diagram where the exact same red zone is the area you are trying to avoid entering yourself.
Okay, but the source text does establish a general baseline rule for the colors themselves, right?
Yes. Red is exclusively used as a hazard tint, while blue is a neutral or positive tint. So red always implies danger, risk, or high cost.
Okay.
But whether you are offensively trying to push the puck into the high cost danger zone to create chaos, or defensively trying to keep it out of that zone, is determined entirely by the written text, not the color.
That makes sense. But here's the massive trap that the text warns about, the depth trap.
Yeah.
I want you, the listener, to visualize this. You are looking at a diagram mapping out the risk of turnovers. You see a very dark, heavily saturated red zone right in front of your own net. And you see a light, faint, barely visible red zone out by the neutral zone blue line.
Okay, you see the difference in saturation.
Does the dark red mean it's a more dangerous hazard?
Well, your visual instinct screams, yes, darker saturation means more intense risk. And in the specific context of this guide's risk management maps, tint strength actually is intended to be a ranking system.
That was ranked.
It explicitly grades the cost of a turnover. A turnover in the dark red slot is demonstrably worse than a turnover in the light red neutral zone.
So my eyes were right. The darker the color, the higher the danger.
In theory, yes. But the expert correction here is vital for anyone actually working with these documents in the real world. You must never rank these zones by eye.
Wait, if the tint strength is literally designed to be your ranking, why can't I just look at how dark the ink is?
Because of the harsh physical limitations of printing and media reproduction?
The laser printer strikes again.
Exactly. The guide explains this explicitly to warn coaches. The tints used in these diagrams are light washes. When a digital playbook is printed out, or worse, when it is photocopied multiple times in jet scale to hand out to a team, a light red and a dark red compressed together.
They just blend.
They become visually indistinguishable muddy grays.
Oh, man. I remember getting handouts in high school that were photocopies of photocopies, and any subtle shading just turned into a solid block of black toner.
Exactly. But the problem elevates from annoying to catastrophic if you try to compare a red zone to a blue zone in black and white.
Why? What happens to the blue?
Due to the algorithmic way grayscale conversion works on most standard office copiers, a light blue wash will actually print darker than a faint red wash.
Oh my God. So
Yes.
if you are a player trying to rank the hazard level purely by looking at how dark the gray ink is on your photocopy, the blue zone, which is supposed to be the safe neutral area, will physically look like the darkest, most dangerous place on the ice. It entirely inverts the hazard ranking.
It is a perfect, predictable failure of visual communication caused by physical media.
That is wild.
This is why the guide establishes an unbreakable rule for reading these zones. Read the order and ranking out of the caption, never off the page itself.
The caption is everything.
It is. The digital picture on an iPad might have three beautiful, distinct shades of red, but the caption will explicitly say, Zone 1 is highest risk, Zone 2 is moderate risk, and so on. The words hold the absolute truth. The shading is just a vulnerable visual aid that might betray you depending on the printer toner.
That is such a profound practical insight. Building a mental model isn't just about knowing the pristine theory. It's knowing how that theory survives contact with the real world, like a cheap locker room laser printer.
Exactly right.
So let's synthesize our invisible geography. What should the listener remember here? Dashed boxes represent abstract mental concepts, not physical pain on the ice.
Check.
Faint dashed lines map invisible sight lines and geometric angles. And most importantly, do not trust your eyes when it comes to color depth or grayscale saturation.
Grayscale will lie to you.
Yes, grayscale will lie to you. The caption is the undisputed king.
A robust understanding requires knowing both the system and the limitations of the medium carrying the system.
Okay, we are entering the final layer of complexity. We have our players, we have their exact routes, we know how they physically engage, and we understand the invisible zones they are navigating.
The complete spatial picture.
But we are missing the most crucial, defining element of the sport of hockey. Diagrams are static, two-dimensional images. They are flat pieces of paper. But hockey happens in four dimensions. It happens in time.
It is a rapid-fire sequence of triggers and events.
Exactly. How do we read chronological order on a flat piece of paper?
This is the ultimate problem of diagramming a dynamic game. How do you show flow without moving pictures? Let's look at the primary mechanism, which is numbered tags.
Numbered tags. So if I am looking at a complex neutral zone regroup, I might see five different arrows converging on one area. How do I know who moved first?
Right.
Did the pass happen before the forechecker arrived, or did the forechecker arrive and physically force the pass?
To solve this chronological puzzle, the guide utilizes small numbered tags placed a short way along the routes themselves.
They look like little floating sticky notes attached to the arrows.
Exactly. And the critical rule to internalize here is that these numbers count routes, not players. They explicitly outline the order of operations.
Right.
So 1, 2, 3.
Right. Route 1 happens, which forces a reaction, triggering route 2, which results in pass 3.
And there is a strict visual boundary here to prevent confusion with the players, right? Because earlier we talked about F1 and F2.
Yes, a very strict boundary. These chronological sequence numbers never, ever sit inside a player's shape.
They have to float.
Exactly. Remember, the letters inside a shape like F1 or D2 are role identifiers, denoting who the player is in that moment. Sequence numbers float freely on the lines of movement.
What happens if you mix them up? If you conflate the two, if you think sequence number 2 means the second forward, you will completely misunderstand both the timing of the play and who is supposed to be executing it.
But even with numbered tags, there is only so much temporal information you can cram into one drawing. If you put 10 sequence numbers on one diagram, it just looks like a plate of spaghetti.
Which brings us to the reality of the medium, the limits of a single frame. A single diagram is, by definition, a single moment in time, a snapshot.
Right. You can't show a full 30-second defensive zone breakout drill from the puck retrieval in the corner to the regroup behind the net to the pass up the wing to the entry into the offensive zone in one drawing.
It's impossible. The solution is structural. If a play requires time to unfold through distinct geographic phases, it requires multiple diagrams, frame 1, frame 2, frame 3.
However, I have to emphasize the danger here that the text points out. If you see two diagrams side by side in a playbook, you cannot automatically assume they are sequential.
This is a very common error. You must read the caption to know if two side-by-side diagrams are a chronological sequence, meaning play 1 happens and then time advances to play 2, or if they are two different strategic options for the exact same instant in time.
Well, option A versus option B based on how the defense reacts.
Yes.
Because if a player reads two distinct options as a chronological sequence, they will be trying to execute two contradictory game plans simultaneously,
which results in total paralysis on the ice.
Again, the caption is king. The text saves you from the ambiguity of the image. Now, we need to discuss a concept that merges everything we've talked about today: geometry, physical engagement, and real-world execution.
The legality question.
Yes, and this is where I have to push back a little on the idea that the diagram dictates everything. Let's return to the defensive zone for a second.
Okay.
I am looking at a diagram. I see a solid triangle, an opposing defenseman holding the blue line, and I see an open circle, my forward. The forward's route ends with a two-bar mark directly on top of that opposing defenseman.
The arrive under control termination symbol we discussed earlier.
Right. So I read the nouns, I read the verbs, I read the termination. Does that mean my playbook is legally instructing me, as the forward, to accelerate and blow that defenseman up with a massive highlight reel body check?
This is a vital philosophical distinction that separates theory from reality. Absolutely not.
It doesn't.
No. The expert distinction here is that diagrams display pure geometry and not legality. The diagram tells you where the route stops, at the physical location of the opposing player. It tells you what the tactical goal is, pressure and containment.
Right.
It does not tell you what degree of physical contact is permitted by the rules of your specific league.
The geometry tells you exactly where you need to be. The rulebook tells you what you are actually allowed to do when you arrive at that geographic point.
Exactly. The source text goes out of its way to explicitly cite the rules to prove this limitation of diagram.
Right, because it changes.
Drastically. Whether you can execute that arrive under control symbol with a bone-crushing body check or merely a stick lift and a positional angle off depends entirely on your league, your age classification, and your gender classification.
Can you give an example?
Sure. For example, the text cites USA Hockey Rule 604A, which strictly prohibits body checking in 12 and under youth classifications, all girls and women's classifications, and non-Czech adult recreational leagues.
And Hockey Canada has parallel structures, right?
Yes. Hockey Canada Rule 7.3 penalizes intentional body checking at the U13 levels and below and across female hockey.
So to put this in perspective for the listener, if a 12-year-old peewee player looks at this exact diagram, they're executing the exact same spatial geometry as a 30-year-old NHL veteran.
Exactly the same.
They skate the exact same route. They arrive at the exact same destination point. They apply tactical pressure. But the 12-year-old angles the opponent off, rubbing them along the boards to steal the puck, whereas the NHL player might throw a devastating hip check.
Same geometry, different application.
The diagram on the whiteboard is identical for both players. The execution is governed completely by the external rulebook.
You must know your rulebook before you can safely execute the diagram's geometry. The playbook assumes you are already fluent in the laws of your specific league. The diagram is a map, not a legal mandate.
So to synthesize this final layer of complexity, numbers floating on the lines dictate the chronological sequence of routes, not the identity of the players.
Got it.
A single frame is just a snapshot in time. If you see multiple frames, rely entirely on the caption to tell you if they are sequential steps or alternative options. And finally, geometry does not equal legal permission to hit. The diagram shows the tactic. The rulebook dictates the physical execution.
If a coach or player can integrate those principles regarding time, sequence, and legality, their ability to read and anticipate the flow of a game on paper will increase exponentially.
We've covered immense ground today. We have completely decoded the matrix of this visual language. We've gone from looking at a chaotic whiteboard of geometric alphabet soup to fluently reading the hidden verbs, nouns, and modifiers of hockey strategy.
It's a whole new way of seeing the game.
It really is. But before we finish, we need to construct a final bulletproof mental framework. If a listener wants to carry this knowledge onto the ice tomorrow, how do we consolidate this? Let's transition into our final synthesis.
To achieve true mastery, you must elevate above memorizing individual shapes and understand the philosophy of the system. If you want to permanently retain the core lessons of this deep dive, these are the four pillars you must build your mental model upon.
Lay them out for us.
First and foremost, context is king. Never ever assume a symbol means the same thing across different whiteboards, manuals, or coaching crees.
Because of the traps.
Yes. The IIHF trap, where shapes represent whole teams rather than specific positions, is your biggest hazard. Always check the legend of the specific document you are reading.
Pillar two, shapes and fills. Circle equals mobile forward. Triangle equals anchored defenseman. Open is us, solid is them, preserving legibility in black and white.
Perfect.
And the golden rule of shapes. They follow the player, regardless of the geographic zone they are in.
Right.
A winger backchecking deep in their own zone is still a circle.
Pillar 3. Lines have logic. They aren't just arbitrary squiggles drawn for convenience.
They mimic reality.
Exactly. From the literal physical mimicry of the C-cut overlapping arches for backward skating to the deliberate necessary omission of the highly ambiguous one-bar stop symbol. The lines are meticulously designed to prevent miscommunication. If a symbol feels strange, look for the physical action it is trying to mimic.
And pillar 4, which has been the recurring theme of almost every single topic we discussed today, read the captions.
Always.
The diagram is just a vulnerable visual aid. The text caption holds the absolute truth about the sequence of events, the actual ranking of color-coded danger zones when the printer fails, and whether a shaded box is a target to attack or a trap to avoid.
Excellent. Now, to compress this even further for immediate high-pressure recall, here are the top 3 practical truths to remember the next time a coach hands you a playbook.
The top 3.
Number 1. A diagram represents one specific system at one specific instant in time. It is not the absolute universal way hockey is played. It is merely one coach's preferred geometric solution for one tactical moment.
Number 2. An X is a pylon, never a player. If you try to pass the puck to an X on a diagram, you are passing to an inanimate piece of plastic.
And number 3, perhaps the most vital practical advice of all for surviving in the real world of hockey. If your coach's whiteboard in the locker room disagrees with the rigorous guide we just studied, the whiteboard wins.
The whiteboard always wins.
Every single time.
If your coach says a square represents a goalie, then for that entire season, you better believe a square is a goalie. You adapt to the local dialect of the person making the roster decisions.
Because ultimate communication is about shared understanding with the people you are actually playing with on the ice, not proving a textbook right in the locker room.
This has been absolutely fascinating. We've seen firsthand how fractured, localized, and ambiguous the visual language of hockey truly is.
It is remarkably chaotic.
We've seen how authors literally have to stitch together symbols from different international organizations, fixing broken lateral line symbols, banning confusing one-bar stops, inventing a symbol for the puck itself just to be understood by their readers.
It is a cobbled together language born out of deep tactical necessity rather than elegant top-down design.
And that leaves me with a final lingering provocative thought for you, the listener, to mull over as we wrap up. We've spent this entire deep dive dissecting this fractured dictionary, learning how to navigate the contradictions and traps.
Right.
But consider this, ice hockey is a massive, highly interconnected global game. The NHL brings in players from North America, Europe, Russia, Scandinavia. They all have to step onto the same ice and execute complex systems together at light speed.
Sure.
So if hockey is this wonderfully global sport, why hasn't the sport developed a truly universal, standardized visual language?
Like sheet music for musicians.
Yes, exactly.
Think about it. A pianist from Japan and a cellist from Germany can sit down in a room together and play a complex symphony instantly without speaking a word of the same verbal language, because the visual language of music on the page is absolute, rigorous, and universal.
Yes. The next time you watch a hockey game and you see the coach frantically pull out that whiteboard during a commercial break,
yeah,
imagine how much smoother a team's communication would be, how much faster they could adapt to a changing game state. If everyone on the ice, from the rookie out of Ontario to the veteran from Sweden, was actually reading from the exact same standardized dictionary,
it would revolutionize the sport.
Until that day comes, you are going to need the Rosetta Stone we just built today. Thank you for joining us on this incredibly intense deep dive. Take this new mental model, go look at some system manuals, and start analyzing the game with a totally new perspective.
Keep questioning what you see, look for the physical logic in the symbols, and always read the caption.
We'll see you next time.